Welcome to Cover Girls, Drinking and Overthinking, in which we take a story we love and analyze how well it was adapted.
I'm Chris.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Allison. Join us as we meticulously pick apart our favorite stories until no stone is left unturned. It'll be bookish.
It'll be boozy.
It'll be bantersome.
And it won't be boring. So grab a drink and get ready to overthink. Let's dig in. Welcome back to Cover Girls, covering Holes, the book. We're on episode 7. Super excited to dig back in. Oh, I don't even mean to use that pun. It's not on purpose, I swear. Chris and Kristen,
it's just the only one we've come up with, really. It's this book is peachy keen. I don't know. Nope, I'm leaving now. I can't top myself after that.
It's like we don't even need puns, but the suggestion of one, like I didn't mean to do it, but I feel so
I
lame.
Need puns.
Okay, well, we discussed before this that we have a lot to get into. Actually, the chapters that we're about to discuss, which starts at chapter 23, if anyone is following along, we're going to go through roughly 40 to 50 pages. We are going to get through as much as we can. We'll do our best. But starting at chapter 23, there's actually a lot to discuss here. And there's more than I thought in regards to book differences from the movie. Now we're getting into some big differences. But before we get into all that, let's talk about what we're drinking. Chris.
All right. Well, so I made up a drink. I'm calling it the Yellow Spotted Lizard.
Ew.
Ooh.
It is a lemon. It's really basic. It's a limoncello liqueur with Prosecco. And then I just garnished it with a little cucumber so that it'd have some green for a lizard.
That actually sounds pretty good.
It's now, so refreshing. It tastes like lemonade, honestly.
Sounds great.
So it's good.
That is not basic at all. I am impressed. I love limoncellos. The closest I've ever gotten to a limoncello is like the LaCroix version.
Oh, yeah. Delicious. Yeah. So. Have you ever had a lemon drop shot?
That's basically the only thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think I've had real limoncello liqueur.
Like the Italian lemon. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is limoncello. I almost copped out and bought like lemon liqueur, but no, I had to be bougie.
Good for you. Heck yeah. Thanks for taking our podcast seriously.
Kristen, what are you drinking?
I am already being put to shame by how cool you are because I am drinking a Coke Zero, which is very cool.
Ooh.
Yeah. I'm continuing in the Coke theme, you know, in the poor Shia LaBeouf not getting a Coca-Cola. I'm reminded with every sip of these poor thirsty boys who would kill for a Coca-Cola and can't have one.
By the way, Coke Zero, to me, is so much better than Diet Coke.
That's it's not a question. Oh my gosh, yes.
What probably would be for Chris.
I am a Diet Coke-aholic.
But there's such a dichotomy. Everybody has a side.
Yeah, but the difference is I actually do not like the taste of regular Coke.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So I'm not looking for a diet soda that tastes like Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
I want the taste of Diet Coke. So, but if you like Coca-Cola, Coke Zero's for you.
Yeah. Mm. I have a friend who's exactly the same way. She says she hates the taste of regular Coke because it tastes, to her, it tastes more like medicine than Diet Coke does, which to me is high nonsense.
Yes.
Wild, yeah. Like, I actually like regular Coke enough. It's not my favorite, but I do like it. I do not like Diet Coke. Diet anything just turns my stomach. I hate it. So when I tasted Coke Zero, I was like, oh, this is way less Diet Coke-y and more like regular Coke. So that explains the difference. Guys, I'm really, really excited to introduce my drink. By the way, listeners, we never discuss what we're drinking ahead of time. It's always a surprise. So I didn't think of a name, but I guess I'll call it Spiced Peach Frosé.
Ooh.
So I was inspired by the very first page of this chapter on chapter 23 that every summer Miss Catherine would pick bushels of peaches and preserve them in jars with cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, and other spices which she kept secret. So I decided to make a peach frosé with spiced rum. So the ingredients are, I have fresh peaches in there. I made this all in a blender, by the way. So fresh peaches. My drink has one whole peach in it, a small one, but one whole peach. So I'm getting a whole serving of fruit. And I've got peach juice, which we all know I love. Chris knows I love peach juice.
Yeah.
And then a shot and a half of spiced rum, and then one shot of peach schnapps. Ooh. And then I put in the spices she mentioned, nutmeg, cinnamon, and cloves. And then she says she has, the author says she has a secret ingredient.
Yeah, what were your secret ingredients?
My secret ingredient was ginger.
Yeah.
Yum.
Okay, that tracks.
That sounds good.
And then there's ice, of course. So I made it all in the blender and made a little frosé.
Yum.
Oh, and I have this cute, look, guys. I have this cute little straw I've been saving that's like candy cane stripe. And the color that's complementing the white is peach colored.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cute.
Maybe that's another secret ingredient is mint.
There you go.
Ooh.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Cheers.
I'm so excited. Okay. Now, we were talking about this before. We're going to try to move more quickly than we have in the past. At the same time, I don't want to leave anything out. So we'll just see how far we get. So starting at chapter 23, we have a flashback. We have a lot of flashbacks in these next few chapters. And so it's Green Lake, which 100 years ago, which was apparently the largest lake in Texas. So it must be huge. And to me, what they describe here with the 4th of July and everything, I mean, politics aside with that holiday, it's still my favorite. And this sounds like the perfect day that they're describing. This is my heaven. Like great food, sunshine, water, picnic blankets, games, dancing, singing, swimming. Like, lay it on me.
You know what it sounds like to me? Like the basis of a Hallmark movie where like the couples meet at like the 4th of July fair. And it's like just so quaint and sweet and America and apple pie. Like, you know.
It's uber Americana. Well, it says on the very next page that Green Lake was heaven on earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And look, I like to consider myself to be a deep, thoughtful person, but I'm very basic when it comes to these kind of simple pleasures. Like, give me water, give me sun, give me barbecue, pie, whatever it may be, and good times and music. And I'm just happy. This is my happy place.
Am I right in thinking that this is our first flashback in the whole book?
But other than the ones about Stanley's family.
Right. This is our first actual Green Lake flashback.
Green Lake, yes.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting foreshadowing here that they say the jarred peaches would last all winter. They probably would have lasted a lot longer than that, but they were always eaten by the end of winter.
So no one ever tested them until...
No one knew if they'd last 100 years.
110.
We have no way of knowing. Yeah, 110. Yeah. I misquoted that earlier. And then we get to Catherine Barlow. They call her Catherine much more than Kate. I'll be interested to see if we even see Kate come up because I just keep seeing Catherine. But anyway, so she's teaching at the schoolhouse and we get an introduction to her adult class, which has Trout Walker. And it says his real name was Charles Walker, but everyone called him Trout because his 2 feet smelled like a couple of dead fish.
And that's something I don't think we got in the movie.
I was going to point out, it was interesting to me that that Lewis Saker opted to leave that out because we kept so many of the other connections.
Yeah. I guess, I don't know if there just wasn't an easy way to tell that flowed with the narration. I don't know.
I guess we just assumed that his name, I think we talked about this, that his name was Trout because like he owned the lake and trout live in lakes. But it says that he had an incurable foot fungus, which it weirdly notes was the same foot fungus that 110 years later Clyde Livingston would have.
Which would have been a really cool detail to include in the movie.
Yeah. But what is the significance of that?
Well,
any ideas?
I mean,
I feel like everything is always tied back to the current story. So everything in the past has to have some kind of connection. And so that was just another connection, bringing everyone full circle.
Sure. Just a way to keep us grounded and make it relevant.
Yeah.
So then it says, Trout often showed up at night school but never paid attention. He talked in class and was disrespectful of the students around him. He was loud and stupid. The narrator does not hold back with how unlikable Trout is. And honestly, I can't stand men like this, people like this in general, but specifically men who have this, like, this superiority complex and, like, what you say doesn't matter. Like, people who are that loud and are disrupting other people's learning. Honestly, as a nerd myself growing up, I couldn't stand when people would talk loudly around me or ask me things while I'm trying to listen to the teacher. Like, I want to learn. And it just really bothers me. He's arrogant. He's disrupting the learning process for other people. Yeah, he's obviously made out to be very unlikable, no questions asked.
We get the foreshadowing for the first time of his brand new boat.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mm-hmm. think we mentioned back when we were doing the movie that it seems a bit early for motorboats.
Yeah, but I think we also ended up looking it up. I don't know if we shared that. I ended up Googling it, and apparently that does work out. Which I was kind of surprised by too.
I think we did note that. But I mean, honestly, I bought it as soon as it said it spewed ugly black smoke. So I was like, okay, it's like a mini steamboat, I guess, to an
gross,
extent.
Yeah, gross little steamboat. Yeah.
Right, like first draft, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we get to the part that we talked about previously where, you know, Kate says, no, thank you. She has no problem just expressing that she doesn't want to go out with Trout. I'm going to read this for the listeners. He says, how would you like to take a ride on my new boat this Saturday? He asked her one evening after class. No, thank you, said Miss Catherine. We've got a brand new boat, he said. You don't even have to row it. Yes, I know, said Miss Catherine. Everyone in town had seen and heard of the Walker's new boat. It made a horrible loud noise and spewed ugly black smoke over the beautiful lake. I do like that, you know, contrast of how he is still spreading his ugliness wherever he goes. Trout had always gotten everything he ever wanted. He found it hard to believe that Miss Catherine had turned him down. He pointed his finger at her and said, no one ever says no to Charles Walker, which is his real name. I believe I just did, said Catherine Barlow. I like this. She's not being antagonistic. She's not making excuses. She's also not being mean. She's just, you know, expressing her boundaries and her wants and desires and no, thank you. That doesn't fit into what I want. No.
She's not going to make herself uncomfortable to make him feel more comfortable.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. I also really, I guess to me, reading about the boat on the lake and how it was spewing the ugly black smoke over the lake, it made me think, okay, so this is the foreshadowing of Trout and his family bringing ruin to Green Lake.
Mm. Totally.
It's the first of many things, but
the first like example of ruin, basically, like what they're bringing.
The beginning of the end brought by the Walkers.
Boom. Yeah, that's it. It is. I thought it was very, very intentional that they included that, you know, the inky smoke or whatever, like pollutes the very beautiful lake. And we see the demise of this lake throughout the entire book through the flashbacks, how it becomes more desolate, less beautiful,
right,
until eventually it's not even there. Any thoughts before we move on, Kristen?
No, I don't think so. I think that pretty much covers it, is that we see, yeah, like you said, Miss Catherine doing something very ordinary. And we know that later she's going to get punished for it.
So we get to chapter 24. We're back to camp. And previously we talked about the effects of rattlesnake venom as far as what the venom being in her fingernails could do to Mr. Sir's face. We learned that in the book, his face had swollen to the size of half a cantaloupe, which is very big.
A lot bigger than what we saw in the movie,
yes,
I think.
I noticed that as well. That is a whole other half face attached to your face.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. And I just wanted to once more bring up the discussion of if anyone has any insight into how realistic this is. I was thinking perhaps, you know, it's not fully in his bloodstream because it was an outside, because it was from the skin, you know, it's not like the fangs can go into the veins. So because it was a superficial wound, I guess it's just enough to get under the skin and cause the same reaction that you would have when a snake bites you, not internally, but on the outside, the bite gets blistered, swollen. And I think that's just the reaction of the skin with the venom, like the underlayer of the skin. Anyway, that seems to track for me, but I don't know a lot. Any thoughts on that?
I tend to agree with that. I mean, what I've always understood from being around rattlesnakes and being given a word of caution about them is that if one bites you in the face, don't even bother like trying to go to the hospital, like say goodbye to the ones you love because it's over. If they, you know, so I would imagine that if you're scratched superficially like that, you're still going to have quite a large reaction, probably similar to what Mr. Sir is experiencing here. But it's, I mean, honestly, what I would expect is for that skin to start dying a little bit and to fall off.
Well, it kind of sounds like
that's my understanding.
Sounds like that's what's happening in the book. And it does kind of seem like they toned it down a teensy bit for the aesthetics of the movie rather than like having him like grow a tumor, basically.
Mm. Yeah.
And I also noticed, I may need a refresher, but I feel like they also toned down Mr. Sir's reaction in the movie.
Yes, I would love to talk about that. That's the next thing up. But in general, it feeds into this impression I have that the book is much more brutal and adult with themes of abuse than the movie was. I can see how they tone down all of the physical harm and, you know, abuse themes throughout the book to make it more kid friendly for the screen. So I can't wait to talk about each of those instances as they come up, starting with this one with Mr. Sir and who's the...
We don't know. Kid? He's just a kid. It just says a boy.
Okay.
Because remember, there are a lot more tents and groups of kids going out than what we saw in the movie.
Not to skip ahead, but later on, I remember that the book mentions like them talking to the other counselors. And I was like, oh, yeah, there are other counselors.
Yeah.
Right.
Because our impression from the movie is like there are three adults at this place.
Yeah.
But,
so,
you know,
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I feel like what the movie did, especially with Mr. Sir and Mom, is they wanted to somewhat make them a little comedic as well, especially Mr. Sir. Mm-hmm. So they toned him down so that he could be someone you could poke fun at.
Yeah.
And get a little comedic relief and levity from it. The book is definitely much heavier.
Absolutely. And Kristen, you're not wrong that this scene is much more brutal in the book. Mr. Sir actually holds the boy's head against the oatmeal pot, which I can only believe is very hot, like actually would burn your face, and then throws him down and his head banged against the table as he fell to the ground, and Mr. Sir stands over him.
Oh, and don't forget, Mr. Sir, the kid can't speak because Mr. Sir has him by the throat.
Oh, right. Continuing to choke the boy and a gurgling sound came out. Exactly. This is much worse.
We've crossed a line from neglect to like outright abuse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that they're abused in many other ways, but they're all without physically laying hands on the child, right?
Yeah.
There are ways that we're going to...
I don't feel like we ever really saw that in the movie so much.
Yeah. This is the first time... I mean, this is... In the movie, I don't think anyone ever laid hands on the kids.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
But it's very different here in the books. Mm-hmm. And, or books, plural, there's one. but also, this just continues. It gets worse and worse as we go on. We've got threats of physical violence. We've got them encouraging them to physically assault each other. It's just much, much worse in this book. And honestly, I'm here for it. It adds a lot of layers and a lot of depth to every character and the journey that they're on, each one of them individually. But we have that instance where, you know, it ends with, "I'm kind of handsome, don't you think?" "Yes, Mr. Sir." Which in the movie he says, "I think I'm kind of purty, don't you think?" Which is just, it's making him a little bit more comedic, and it's also feminizing him a little bit, a little more heavy-handedly, right? Because that's part of the comedy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Foreshadowing his name reveal later on, perhaps.
Exactly. And I thought there was some really, really good writing here on page 106. So this is when Mr. Sir is denying caveman water, which we talked about enough in the movie episodes. We've agreed this is actually very dangerous. He could definitely pass out from dehydration. He could have some major problems from this. But I liked this writing where it says, Stanley watched the water splatter on the dirt because he's, you know, just missing his canteen on purpose, where it was quickly absorbed by the thirsty ground. And, you know, if you've ever been out in the heat where the ground is just dry, it's desolate, it's just hot, hot, hot dirt, you know what it looks like to pour water on that kind of dirt and it just absorbs so quickly. Mm-hmm. It's gone. Mm-hmm. That's how hot it is. I don't know. I just found that very like visceral and relatable. I was like, yeah, like this guy knows what he's talking about. And it says, Stanley stared at the dark spot on the ground, which quickly shrank before his eyes. The way he's writing this, it's just so real. When it's that hot out, the water goes immediately. And it's just such mm-hmm. a waste. You're like, that could have been hydrating caveman, giving him strength, like keeping him alive. And instead, it's literally just the ground drinking it up in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Anything else on that chapter?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up. I mean, again, that's some pretty severe child abuse.
It is. All right, so chapter 25, we have another flashback to Old Green Lake. And we hear Sam called Sam the Onion Man, which is nice and alliterative. And it says that Sam had big, strong arms, but it would still take all day for him to row across the lake and another day for him to return, which means this lake really must be the biggest in Texas. A whole day to row across. You can't go back and forth in a single day. That's big.
Well, also you're going to get tired. You're going to need breaks like halfway across the lake.
It just, again, like goes to show how drastically this place has changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, now there's not a drop of water in sight.
And I think it's also interesting that Trout is not necessarily a product of his family. He is a product of their privilege and their wealth. But it says most of the time, the Walkers, which is his real last name, would let Sam board Mary Lou in their shed free of charge. Mm. So Mary Lou's the donkey. And he just lets Sam, you know, the Walkers let Sam keep him there whenever he wants. They're not like bad people. They seem relatively generous in that sense. They're like, yeah, sure, use it. And so Trout himself, the son, is particularly entitled and cruel.
Yeah, we don't really
learn. It's that second generation.
We don't really learn anything about attitude. Trout's family, do we? Except for the fact that they let Sam use their shed. That's like the only thing we know about them.
Yeah. No, we don't know anything else about the generations above Trout. Now we do know more about what came after him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's about as good as Trout.
And this is a big difference. In the book, Sam claims Mary Lou was almost 50 years old. Which wasn't it a lot bigger in the movie?
I want to say almost 100.
Did? I don't remember.
I thought so. I think
50 is like almost believable.
Right. I feel like when it's been a minute since we watched the movie, but I feel like it was a big enough number that we all kind of took pause at that moment of being like, okay, we all know the donkey's not that old. But maybe
I think so too.
I think it was an outrageous. Right, it was an outrageous.
Because I feel like
there,
we were saying something about how like how awful it is that this donkey lived to be 100 and then they killed it.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure it was over 100.
I had it in my head, if not out loud.
Right. And which, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what really tickles me, I love how good of a salesman Sam is. I mean, he's going to get them coming and going. Oh, you've got this issue, onions. You got,
oh my God, right?
Your girlfriend left you onions. Like everything.
Not only that, but he sells them to the doctor. He sells them to the doctor as a health remedy. Yeah. That's pretty impressive.
For his boldness.
Yeah, even the doctor's on board.
Right? So I looked it up and donkeys actually typically live 25 to 40 years. So 50 is believable enough. It says she's almost 50, which gives us that mystical aspect, which the movie plays way more into. The donkey is like 100 years. There's ghosts that we're seeing of people from the past. It just plays more heavy-handedly into the mysticism. But I like how subtle it is in the books. And I wanted to point out, I did a little research on this. So as far as the donkey, Mary Lou, only eating onions, donkeys do apparently do very well with high fiber diets, which onions are high in fiber. However, onions are toxic to most animals. If you have a dog or a cat, you probably know this, and donkeys are no exception. It's not as bad for donkeys as it is for dogs and cats, but it's still toxic to them on some level. So this does not actually hold up to science. And also, just fun fact, potatoes are not good for donkeys. If you have a donkey, do not feed them potatoes.
Well, that's good to know, because we do have a donkey.
Oh, we do! Chris, tell them about our donkey.
So we have a donkey at our family's ranch named Max. Aww. I don't know how old Max is, but he's pretty old because, I mean, what? He's been with us for like 15 years.
I mean, I was at least 14 when he came. So Well, that's 16 years ago.
16
oh,
years.
Oh, now y'all know how old I am. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
he's at least 16. And I mean, when we got him, he was, you know, of course, fully grown. So he's got to be at least 2 years old. So at minimum, Max is 18 years old. Minimum.
And y'all, he is the friendliest thing. We'll go to the ranch and like we have horses there too. And I would say the majority of the horses want nothing to do with us because they're used to being ridden and they're like, no, not today. But Max, who's never had a worry or care in his life, just wants to come up to you and get all the pets. Aww. He's hoping that you'll leave a sack of corn out somewhere that he can just munch on. He is the friendliest, sweetest little thing, and he's short and he's just so cute.
He's so cute. I think my favorite thing about Max is that he thinks he's one of the horses.
He does. He Aww. Does.
He's never had another donkey around. He's only been around horses. So he goes everywhere with them. And like Chris said, they don't really pay attention to him, but he follows them everywhere. He eats what they eat. He like socializes the same way as them. So he's probably slightly different than a regular donkey. Because he thinks he's a horse.
He does.
That's all he knows.
He's Max the donkey horse.
Oh, bless his little donkey horse heart. And for the record, that only holds true if the onions are regular onions. These are Sam's magic onions, and you don't know how they affect donkeys.
True.
You know, and yeah, we've never actually resolved whether or not there is a magical aspect to this book. Because in the movie, we have the ghost thing going on.
Right.
And so we're sort of led to believe that maybe there's a little magic. And so I don't know. I guess we're led to believe that curses are real.
That's the thing, I think, because the curse is clearly real since it gets remedied.
Yeah.
I think that means that magic exists.
So the onions could be special,
right? Which I had not considered before, actually. But yeah, they could be like magical onions,
because I was genuinely just thinking they're really sweet onions. Not
Same.
Like
that's
yeah,
what I thought.
Not magical.
I mean, I don't think they cure the things that Sam it doesn't seem to imply that they actually cure anything.
To me, this is implying that Sam is a really good salesman. He's telling everybody Mary Lou's 50 years old. She's probably like 15 years old. He's telling everyone it'll cure everything. Doc Hawthorne often smelled like onions, even though he was perpetually bald.
Right.
It didn't indicate that he was growing hair. Just said he smelled like onions.
This has been going on since the dawn of time. These holistic, you know, medicine trends. It's still happening. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, apple cider vinegar cures everything. Coconut oil.
Oh, coconut oil.
Acai was a big trend for a while.
Yeah, acai. There's always these superfoods. And don't get me started on it, because nutritionists have debunked all. Okay, I'm not even going to go there. Okay.
I know. Easy. I thought about going there myself in this podcast. And I was like, no, just here's the thing. I believe in a balance. Like, I think that you should eat healthy. I think that, you know, the way that people centuries before us survived was by finding, you know, certain benefits in different foods and chemicals and whatever. Of course, they have their benefits, but I will never take you seriously if you tell me that, you know, X being a naturally occurring, you know, organic material or whatever, if you tell me that that is going to cure a physical ailment or a disease or something medical, I'm going to say no, go get prescription meds.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, like y'all said, this has been going on, I mean, really since the dawn of time, right? There's always like some miracle cure. And people back in this time period made a lot of money going around peddling crap, telling people. And do you know, y'all probably know this, and many of the listeners may as well, but I'm going to say it anyways. The reason why there are not very many mummies left is because the Westerners were grinding down the mummies and using them as a like powder that they would like take to cure their ailments. I'm not joking. It was a thing.
They also and used them. Gross. They also used them as paint. There was apparently a particularly kind of good brown that you could get from grinding up mummies.
Mummy brown. Yep. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Y'all, it reminds me of the shark fin stuff going on in Asia. It's just disgusting. But anyway, we can move on. So we get to the first "I can fix that" line. You know, Miss Catherine says that the roof leaks. Sam says, "I can fix that." And we get this quote. Sam laughed. "I'm good with my hands," he told her. "I built my own boat." Impressive. Catherine couldn't help but notice his strong, firm hands. Y'all, I was getting a little like turned on.
He's got strong, firm hands. Who wouldn't?
And he's good with them. And he built his own boat. I was like, yeah.
She's thirsty.
She is.
This town is small.
Very small. There are probably no other attractive men here, really. And it took Sam a week to fix the roof because he could only work in the afternoons. And she gave him 6 jars of spiced peaches. Okay, I recognize that this is more of a romantic, like, kindling thing. Like, it's not really about a fair trade. But is this a fair trade? For a whole week, he came and did manual labor for 2 to 3 hours, and she gives him 6 jars of spiced peaches.
We don't know how long they last, though. Like, we don't know how big these jars are.
Well, we do know that Zero and Caveman later on eat 1 jar together in 1 sitting, and they're not even full.
That's true.
Yeah. So it's probably like a regular mason jar.
I think so, yeah. Anyways, I just thought that was like, he keeps doing all this manual labor for her.
He obviously wants to be with her. Yeah.
Speaking of magical onions, he told her about his secret onion field on the other side of the lake where the onions grow all year round and the water runs uphill, which we learn later on is kind of a weird, the water running uphill, like that's a magical, unusual physical phenomenon that indicates like something paranormal is going on here, which to me kind of implies that Sam just happened upon these naturally growing onions and then was like, you know what? I'm not going to ask too many questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the first time I think we find out that Sam is black.
Yes.
And so, which is an important part of the story the story of these two lovers.
To be fair, this is also our only introduction to Sam. I know it feels like it's not, but like,
yeah, this whole chapter.
That's true.
It feels like we've known him a lot longer because he's so entwined in the story with us.
It does. And actually, there's a really crucial difference here in this chapter from the movie. So, you know, we've got the whole, I can fix that multiple times. She keeps trying to keep him around to fix the windows, then whatever else there is. And so finally, she sees him outside the schoolhouse and it's like, oh God, he's looking sexy. I'm just like really missing him. So she runs out there and just kind of like, instead of hugging him, hugs the donkey. And he says, is something wrong? Oh, Sam, my heart is breaking. I can fix that. She turned to him. He took hold of both of her hands and kissed her. Because of the rain, there was nobody else out on the street. Even if there was, Catherine and Sam wouldn't have noticed they were lost.
You dumb idiots.
World.
Just like we talked about before, if you're going to kiss, close the window, get off of the street.
If you know that what you're doing is illegal, then yeah.
This takes it to a whole nother level. You know, in the movie, they're inside the schoolhouse. Maybe no one would have seen them. You're in the GD street. Like, come on.
Well,
you know someone's
going to
see
you. And so, of course, someone does see them. And we see actually the first indication that this isn't just destiny. It's it's in some form, it's God, because somebody comes out and we hear the first iteration of the town's catchphrase, God will punish you.
So that brings us to chapter 26. No kids show up for school the next morning because the word has already spread that they were kissing. And, so Trout brings the mob in to the schoolhouse to burn all her books because it matters to her, which is so stupid. We already talked about how you're handicapping your own kids. But he says, there she is, the devil woman. And do you know what this reminds me of? He immediately turns from begging her to go out with him to calling her the devil woman. And I'm like, these are those guys that want to go out with you so badly. And then when you reject them, say that you're actually ugly or you're a slut and they don't want you anyway.
Yeah, that tracks.
It's very grapes. Like incel behavior.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, his feet are too stinky for anyone to like him, you know, the way he is. So he's got to use his, like, power. So, you know, this happens similarly to the movie. But then when Kate runs to the sheriff, you know, he says, kiss me. And she slaps him across the face. And it says, he laughed. You kissed the onion picker. Why won't you kiss me? She tried to slap him again, but he caught her by the hand. He tried to wriggle free. So basically, I'm just getting this sense of, like, dang, the power dynamics here. He's not even offended or fazed by the fact that she slapped him. It's like he's so much more powerful than her that it's like swatting a fly, you know?
Yeah.
So he says it's against the law for him to kiss you, not for you to kiss him. And she declared, we're all equal under the eyes of God. The sheriff laughed. Then if Sam and I are equal, why won't you kiss me? He laughed, I'll make you a deal. One sweet kiss and I won't hang your boyfriend. I'll just run him out of town. Miss Catherine jerked her hand free. As she hurried to the door, she heard the sheriff say, the law will punish Sam and God will punish you. Now, I want to talk about this. This doesn't happen in the movie. He gives her an opportunity, if she kisses him, that he will spare Sam.
I mean, he's not going to.
And she doesn't do it. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about. You think he wouldn't have?
No. I mean, he's saying whatever he has to get his little kiss. But I don't have. Do you think he would have? Do you think he would have kept his word?
I wasn't really considering the fact that he wouldn't keep his word. I was just thinking about this as an actual trade. And would you do it?
I think she knows he's not going to keep his word.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Kristen. I don't think that the sheriff is already proving that he's not a moral person, right? I don't think that he is probably the kind that would stick to his word. I think he's just trying to be gross and, you know, trying to get a little, he's trying to make his point. He's not actually expecting her to take him up on his offer. He's trying to make the point that, look, you're loose. You're a loose woman because you kissed a Negro man, as he says. And so, what's wrong with me? You got, you know, he's just trying to make a point. That's all. I'd never considered that he would actually let Sam go.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So another difference here is that they actually try to run away together. So she comes and finds him and she says, we've got to go now. They're going to hang you. And guys, I actually cried. I'm not kidding. I openly sobbed at this part. I see Chris nodding. So he says, come on, Mary Lou, like to get on the boat with them to leave. And she says, we have to leave Mary Lou behind. Sam stared at her a moment. There were tears in his eyes. Okay. And he just says, okay. Like, imagine your dearest pet and you have to leave them behind. I guess because she's too big, she'll slow them down. Like, I guess that's why. But it's really, really sad to me, like, thinking of your most, like, beloved pet and just having to leave them in that moment to save you
and your confused,
love.
They're confused. They're, oh, it's devastating. And then to know what happens to Mary Lou.
Yeah.
It's...
Oh, my God. I'll read it. I'll read it for you guys. So these are the facts, it says. The Walker boat smashed into Sam's boat. And this is different than the movie. Sam was shot and killed in the water. Catherine Barlow was rescued against her wishes. When they returned to the shore, she saw Mary Lou's body lying on the ground. The donkey had been shot in the head. That all happened 110 years ago. Since then, not one drop of rain has fallen on Green Lake. You make the decision. Whom did God punish? So the author breaks the fourth wall, just like we see in the movie, and addresses the reader which I guess you would call like authorial intrusion, but it's the same kind of thing where the author is talking to us, just like some of the actors were in the movie version.
When did the actors talk in the movie, break the fourth wall in the movie? I remember the actors talking in the movie.
Well, not to us, but to camera, like you pointed out, the four times.
Oh, when they look straight at the camera. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then, of course, not willing to wait for God's punishment, Miss Catherine takes the law into her own hands.
Mm-hmm. And kills the sheriff with a big ol' wet red kiss. So we get back to camp in chapter 27.
So 3 days have passed since the warden had scratched Mr. Sir.
And he's still not giving Stanley water. But Mr. Pendansky is giving him a little extra every time because he knows this. And for a second, you start to like Mr. Pendansky. For a second, which quickly goes away. And Caveman's feeling uncomfy because everyone is watching Zero dig part of his hole while he just sits there. And they're making this big deal about like, oh, you know, King Caveman. Like, it must be so nice to have your slaves and stuff. And they really bring up race here. So like X-Ray and Armpit are really going in on like, same old story. White boy sits around while the black boy does all the work. Ain't that right? Stanley's like, no, it's not right. X-Ray's like, yeah, it's not right. Ain't right at all. And he's trying to say, like, if the roles were reversed and X-Ray had a chance for someone else to dig his hole, like, in exchange for reading lessons, then he wouldn't be acting this way. So we've got some racial tension here that goes on for a while.
And that I will say, upon looking at this again right now, it's made it that much harder on Stanley that Zero doesn't talk because he's left to sort of defend the entire situation. Mm. And he's also like the white kid in the situation. Mm-hmm. So he's sitting there going, no, everything's fine. Like it's equal. Like it's a give and take type of thing.
And yeah, that's true. Like I'm sure from their perspective, Zero's not even talking about it or saying that he's okay with this arrangement.
Yeah.
And in this version, we have to remember Caveman's bigger than all of them.
Yeah. That's right. Quite a bit bigger.
He big boy.
We move on. Mr. Sir comes back with water, and this time he fills Caveman's canteen, but brings it behind the truck, does something weird, comes back out, and tries to get Stanley to drink it in front of him, which is never a good sign.
So he definitely peed in it, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, what do y'all think was put in there? What I thought of was Wedding Crashers when they put the eye drops in Bradley Cooper's drink.
What a weirdly specific pull.
I love it. I was thinking he urinated in it, but at the same time, I was like, this is a children's book. Like, would he? I don't know. But that's all I can think of.
I mean, he could. The other thing was spit in it, but that's not gross enough, I don't think.
The only reason I didn't think that he peed in it was because he got into the truck to do it. And I guess I always, like, I don't think about men, like, sitting in a truck peeing. Mm-hmm. I think of them standing. But men, feel free to send us your comments
on this.
And let us know if it's possible.
I guess there is an implication, though, with him getting inside the truck. It's like he's getting something to put in there, like something he planned. But I could not think of what that would be.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Listeners, tell us what you think. We'd love to hear your theories. So, Stanley is now giving reading and writing lessons. And he's teaching Zero how to spell his name. And interestingly enough, so he doesn't know Hector's name yet. So he's teaching him to spell Zero, Z-E-R-O. And Zero writes it over and over and over and over. And I was thinking this right before Caveman said it. In a way, it made him sad. He couldn't help but think that 100 times Zero was still nothing.
Isn't that sad?
I have a star next to that as well.
Super sad. And then he tells him his name is Hector Zeroni, which just like we talked about in the movie, Stanley's not surprised by. So somehow he does not know the Zeroni last name.
I don't think he would, though. I don't think that part of the story has gotten passed down.
In the movie, I felt like it was sort of implicated. But maybe, I mean, realistically, I don't think that name would be passed down over generations. I think that you would say, well, there was an old gypsy
woman. Right, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So chapter 28, we're in another flashback, and now Green Lake is dried up. The town is gone. But a big difference here with Kate Barlow coming back is that she lives in this cabin for 3 months.
Yeah, whereas in the movie, I feel like we're left with the impression that she was like coming back and then was, I guess, either dehydrated. Was she dehydrated or was she injured?
I think she was dehydrated.
I don't know. The impression I got was just like she knew or decided that it was her time and came back to Sam.
Yeah.
Right. And
hung out under the Mary Lou boat in the movie. But here we've got the cabin.
Exactly. She's in a cabin. She stays there for 3 months and it says, oh, I've just got to read this because this is the other time I cried while reading this. She knew she was crazy. She knew she'd been crazy for the last 20 years. Oh, Sam, she would say, speaking into the vast emptiness. I know it is hot, but I feel so very cold. My hands are cold. My feet are cold. My face is cold. My heart is cold. And sometimes she would hear him say, I can fix that. And she'd feel his warm arm across her shoulders. And the reason this made me cry is not just that she's missing him, but there's a loss of what could have been in the sense that, you know, all they ever got to do, they had a few moments in the schoolhouse and she kissed him once. She got to feel those arms around her once. She never got to know what it would be like to be more intimate with him in any way, to have long, deep conversations with no one watching you, to fall asleep together, to kiss again. Like, there's just so many things she didn't get to do.
Mm.
And the absence of that makes me very sad. What do you guys think?
I mean, it changed the trajectory of her entire life. I mean, I understand that they lived during a time where they may have not been able to legally marry, but they could have made a life together somewhere and had children and had a very full life if they'd been left alone.
Right? Yeah, just off on their own, right?
Yeah. And there's a huge grieving process, I think, that happens when you lose a future.
Yes.
And I think that that happens not just in a situation like this where you lose a love, but I think it happens when, like, for example, a couple finds out they can't have children. And that's a loss of a future for them. And I think there's many ways that someone can relate to that.
I agree, sis. Mm-hmm. Completely. So we also get this quote from Trout. So Trout and his wife, Linda Miller, show up trying to look for the loot at the cabin. This is much more brutal in the book than it was in the movie. I mean, I just keep seeing the brutality amplified to 10 here in the book. But we were talking about where we think this place exists in Texas, even though it's fictional. Chris and I agreed it's probably like far west Texas. And Trout does say, you've robbed every bank from here to Houston. So I do think it's far west Texas, because that would imply that's a lot of length. It's the length of the entire state, with Houston being far on the east side. So I think it must be far west Texas if he says that. And they become increasingly physical with Kate. And you guys know what happens here. I want y'all to take the lead because I feel like I've been talking a lot. This is incredibly brutal. Who wants to take the lead on addressing this?
Chris, go for it.
Okay. Well, I mean, Linda is much more physical in the book than she was in the movie. I mean, in the movie, I remember she was just like, she had a gun and she was just kind of like, give it to us, give it, you know, like pointing it at her. And that was about it.
That's but a great here, impression.
I mean, thank you. I try. Linda grabs Kate by her hair and says, we're not going to kill you, but by the time we're finished with you, you're going to wish you were dead. I mean, so the threats are different. The physicality, they drag her out of bed. She's just wearing her pajamas. She doesn't have any shoes on. They're forcing her to walk out into the desert heat barefooted. Like, we've established it is freaking hot out there.
Ouch.
So without shoes on, think about like when you're barefoot in hot sand, like how much that hurts. That's what I'm imagining. And so they're like, you know, take us to your loot. And she's going, I don't know what you're talking about. And they're saying, you know, well, they're shoving their guns into her. It says that her feet were black and blistered. And that whenever she stopped, Linda whacked her with the shovel.
You know how much willpower it takes and determination to keep going and not lead them to the loot and give them what they're asking for, even though it doesn't make a difference to you except mm-hmm. for pride and vengeance, to not do that when your feet are black and blistering like that, black and blistering with no relief ever until
the
you
the older up. I get, the more I understand, like, people giving up information under, like, pain and pressure. When I was young, I would think, no matter what they did to me, I wouldn't give up that information. And now, I don't know if it's just, like, understanding that, like, we're not invincible, like, and growing up and understanding pain. And, I mean, giving birth to a child kind of shows you what real pain can be like. And now I'm like, if they even started to pull up one of my fingernails, I'd be done. Like, I would just be, I'd be like, what do you want to know? I mean, unless it had to do with my family or something, you know?
Well, but in a sense, there are certain things it does. Trout Walker is maybe the only person that she wouldn't give it up to.
Yeah, perhaps so. But one of the things I find interesting about the way that she dies here, which I figure we're all thinking, she did not, in a sense, commit suicide like she did in the movie.
Yes, it's very different.
Yeah, it's happenstance. The lizard lands on her and bites her bare ankle. So that's different than when she takes mm-hmm. it lovingly in her hand in the movie mm-hmm. and lets it bite her. Very intentional.
Yeah, she's clearly happy about that it lands on her ankle, but it doesn't seem to be an idea
that she's fine with it.
She wants death, but I thought it was unrealistic in the movie where, oh, there just happens to be a yellow spotted lizard the moment your enemies show up and you want to die. Whereas here, for days, they're like torturing her, and then they happen across a lizard, and, you know, Trout and his wife try to shoot it. They can't. It lands on her, and she happens to die, and she's grateful. Like, this is much more realistic to me. And it says that its white tongue, the yellow spotted lizard, its white tongue lapped up the droplets of blood that leaked out of the wound. And Kate smiled. There was nothing they could do to her anymore. Start digging, she said, which I've always loved that line. Where is it? Linda screamed. Where'd you bury it? Trout demanded. Kate Barlow died laughing.
Love it.
And we actually get into part two. This book is in three parts. And for chapter 29, we're back at camp. And I like this quote. It was almost as if the temperature had gotten so hot that the air itself was sweating. That's very palpable.
Well, that's because they mention now we have humidity on top of triple digit heat. Y'all. It's one thing to have triple digit heat in Vegas where it's dry and it's like, mm-hmm. okay, that feels more like 90. No. If you have humidity, that's a different beast.
It is. And there's rain off in the distance, you know, and just like in the movie, they're like, come on, little cloud, or whatever. Like, they want the rain really badly, but of course there's no hope. And this description actually reminds me of New Mexico, Chris. It's talking about these far off lightning storms and how vast the space is. Sound travels a great distance across a barren wasteland. Like, the lightning flashes light up these mountains in the distance. It's just very New Mexico like.
Very much like the wide open prairie.
Absolutely. I love it. And I think this is really cute. When they're asking for the rain, Squid says, maybe it'll rain so hard it'll fill up the whole lake. We can go swimming. This reminds me, they're just little kids.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they're kids, lest we forget. Because sometimes I do forget when I'm reading this.
Same. Absolutely. It just breaks my heart. And they start, X-Ray starts joking about, like, you know, making an arc 40 days and 40 nights. And Zigzag says, right, Get 2 of each animal, 2 rattlesnakes, 2 scorpions, 2 yellow spotted lizards. Like, that's how horrible this desolate wasteland is.
There are 3 types of animals
they would load. And then I noticed something, I'm sure you guys did too. Caveman in the books here, or I keep saying books plural, in the book, Caveman notices God's thumb way earlier than in the movie. This is in the back of his mind for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He notices God's thumb here, thinks of his family's history, and then it never leaves his mind for the rest of the book.
Yeah, I feel like in the movie, we weren't given the sense that he knew about God's thumb until he was out in the desert with Zero.
Right. Mm-hmm. He just suddenly like holds his hand up and he's like, wait, that kind of looks like a thumb. But it says at the end of this chapter, the image of the fist and thumb remained in Stanley's head. Although instead of lightning flashing behind the thumb, in Stanley's mind, the lightning was coming out of the thumb as if it were the thumb of God. So he knows what it is. He's pretty sure this is what he heard about in his family history. Which is interesting because like moving forward, he has more of a game plan. When he goes after Zero, he does have an intention.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to chapter 30. It's Zigzag's birthday, which he wants everyone to know.
Or he claims it's every his birthday. Single turn.
He claims July 8th, which I got excited when I read it because I was like, oh, that's today. And then I realized it's June.
It is not today.
1 month up. It was almost serendipitous. So Zigzag's asking for all this special treatment for his birthday, which, you know what? Relatable. When it's my birthday, that's my one day to get special treatment. So I hear you, Zigzag. And Stanley is like realizing how many holes he's dug since he got here, realizes he's on hole number 45, says to himself, the 45th hole is the hardest. Even though he knows it isn't true, he's doing anything to get through this. And we move on to him saying it was possible he realized that he was somewhere near where Kate Barlow had robbed his great-grandfather. If that was really her lipstick to be found, then she must have lived somewhere around here. So he's putting pieces together far sooner than we see in the movie.
Far sooner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he had realized it was a tube of lipstick in the movie. Did he?
He does, but I don't remember.
He said something about it being like his mom's lipstick, right?
Right. I don't think he realizes that it's Kate Barlow's.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, he definitely, I think it's after he goes to, no, it's like the same as in the book, right? It's after he goes to the warden's office that he thinks about what it might be. I don't know. I remember him saying he thinks it's a lipstick tube. And I remember him saying, I think it belonged to Kiss and Kate Barlow.
We have another, big showdown between Caveman and Zero and everyone else with Zero digging his hole. It's getting contentious. Race is brought in a lot. And Mr. Pendansky shows up and gives them their lunch, which, guys, ugh, it is some kind of meat and cheese mixture that came in a can. Canned meat and cheese.
Ugh.
Like, ew.
I was thinking about the fact that I'd probably just die of starvation.
Yeah, we find out that like literally almost everything is from a can.
Yeah, canned cheese to me is grosser than canned meat. Like, I've had Spam, it's not great, but whatever. But canned cheese?
Nacho cheese is canned cheese.
Yeah, and I hate nacho cheese, if we're being honest.
See, I'll eat that. And I'll eat Velveeta. I mean, they're not my favorite, but what else would canned cheese be? Like, I don't want, like, that cheese whiz.
Spray cheese, that's what it is. It's cheese whiz.
Yeah.
It's cheese product. They're not legally allowed to call it cheese.
But it also sounds like the meat and cheese are in the same can.
That's very possible.
Some kind of meat and cheese mixture that came in a can.
That's somehow grosser than either the canned meat or the canned cheese.
Yes, it is somehow grosser.
Mm-hmm.
So they get in a fight, and Mr. Pendansky is encouraging it. We see this in the movie, but we get way more detail here, and I'm excited to talk about it. Again, this book is much more brutal than the movie. So Zigzag is trying to force Caveman to eat his cookie, pushing him. And Mr. Pendansky says to Stanley, go ahead, Stanley, hit him back. You're bigger. Stanley stared at Mr. Pendansky in astonishment. Teach the bully a lesson, he said. Zigzag hits him. Teach me a lesson, he challenged. So finally, Stanley makes the first hit, but it's not even like a good one. He doesn't know how to fight. And all Zigzag was waiting for, and Mr. Pendansky and everyone else, they were just waiting for an excuse to gang up on Caveman. Caveman throws that first punch, which doesn't even do anything. And Zigzag goes to town on him, destroys him brutally, prompting Zero. This makes more sense in the book. Zero chokes him because Zigzag is like beating the shit out of Caveman.
Nobody else is stepping in.
Not even the counselor.
No.
Well, Pendansky is trying to tell him to stop, but like clearly like he's unleashed this.
Yeah, and he doesn't know how to stop it.
He does try to stop it after it's gone on a while. Then, you know, Zero gets involved and he's still trying to stop it. Like, you're going to kill him. Which you weren't worried about Caveman's well-being earlier. Whatever. So Pendansky fires his pistol right after they've all the boys come in and pull him apart. And the other counselors, like Kristen mentioned.
Oh, I love this sentence. The other counselors came running. They had their guns drawn. So it's not a Mr. Sir thing. They show up at this like at this children's camp for work. And the first thing their boss says is, here is your gun.
Yeah.
Yes. So I underlined that too. And I actually thought it was just because the terrain is so rough. And there's so many dangers, like, from the wire.
I mean, I assume it's for lizards. It's not for children. But, like, that's... I just can't get over how funny that is.
Yeah, it's a hostile environment for these kids. It's a hostile environment for everyone. And I think they're just painting the picture really well with, like, oh, everyone just carries guns on them, you know?
Yeah.
Because you have to. Finally, the warden comes out, too, and everyone learns that Stanley is teaching Zero to read in exchange for Zero digging part of his hole. And the warden is like, no more of that. That's not building character. And Caveman is so aware in the books. He's very astute and intuitive. He says, isn't it more important for him to learn to read? Doesn't that build character more than digging holes? Which, of course, it does in a way. But the warden says, that's his character. What about yours? Which is a great comeback. Sure. You know, Zero's building character maybe by learning to read, but you're getting a break from the reason you're here, and you get to just teach, you know. Not that teaching's easy. Me and Kristen have both been teachers many times in our lives, but I do get it. So she shuts it down, and they start to all the counselors gang up on Zero, berating him and asking him to spell, oh, what have you learned, and laughing at him. And again, I would love for someone else, you know, to take this part over. Like, what are your thoughts? Please, this is horrible.
I mean, they're all ganging up on Zero and using him as a punching bag. Like, obviously not in the physical sense, but, like, it's become clear over time, especially with Mr. Pendansky. If you are, like, a weak person who has very little control, Zero's the person that you can at least control. And, like, use to exert power. And that happens, I mean, they, even with him answering their questions, because I mean, he's doing well. He's spelling, you know, he said cat when they spelled it out. He did fat.
Well, this is different from the movie. In the movie, they're trying to prod him and Zero's refusing to play along. In the book, the warden starts asking him, okay, what does C-A-T spell? And Zero's like, cat. And they actually play along for a second. But even though he proves that he can read, they're still not, they keep prodding him until he makes a mistake, which is really cruel.
They're just waiting for him to fail. That's the sad thing.
And what makes me really upset is Mr. Pendansky's comment. He's a genius, all right. He's so stupid, he doesn't even know he's stupid.
I'm literally making a barfing gesture, guys. Like, oh, it's so horrible.
It's so unnecessarily cruel.
Annie even says, I know you mean well, Stanley, but face it, Zero's too stupid to learn to read. That's what makes his blood boil, not the hot sun. Because he's so stupid and stressed from these learning.
Yeah, he said it causes him stress. Like he's like he's so incredibly like dumb.
When he hands him the shovel, he says, here, take it, Zero. It's all you'll ever be good for. what kind of counselor or ultimately person speaks to another human being this way?
Well, what kind of rehabilitation is that? Right. Like, how do you expect to talk to someone that way and then expect them to go back into the world and believe that they're capable of being a functioning member of society and not committing another crime?
Right.
Well, they know that Zero's not getting rehabilitated. He doesn't have any family to go back to. They know perfectly well that Zero's there until he dies, which probably will be in the next 5, maybe 10 years.
That's a sad thought. I didn't think about what they might think would happen to Zero after this.
I guess I would have assumed that this is a juvenile facility and that at age 18, he's still in the government records at this point. He hasn't run away. Nobody's hacked into the system. So I imagine he'd be let go from the facility and have to make it on his own.
Or he might be transferred to a men's prison.
Yeah, if he's still serving time. Yeah. I don't know how long he has.
Right, we don't know his sentence.
I don't know I don't know what happens to juveniles when they get sentenced and then reach adulthood. But that's a conversation for another time.
For what it's worth, the judge will specifically say you're sentenced to, if you're 17, 1 year in juvenile, at which point you will be transferred over to whatever men's prison.
The penitentiary. Yeah. Okay. But so he may be serving more time. I don't know. But I doubt he'd be at Camp Green Lake for the next 10 years.
Well, my point is more, they know they have no one to answer to with Zero.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, they're not accountable to anybody.
Yeah. So we get to the point where Zero decides to run off, and it's just as epic as it is in the movie, where he hits him with a shovel. And in the movie, he's like, he finally answers the CAT thing. And he's like, cat, as he, or what is it? D-I-G, dig, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's dig. Yeah. And
So he runs off, and they let him go just like they do in the movie. Like,
oh, and we get the sentence water. As soon as he hits Pendanski, the counselors all drew their guns.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Again, lots of counselors, they all have guns.
You know how when you went to camp when you were 10 and they all had guns, remember?
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if that's realistic, if a child was breaking out of juvenile detention, if they would draw guns to try to shoot the child.
I suppose we don't know what's protocol here and what these idiots just do on their own.
I would imagine that you don't. A men's prison, you would.
Well, I mean, immediately, like, the counselors all draw their guns, and then the first thing the warden says is, don't shoot. The last thing we need is an investigation.
Well, yeah. Okay. My impression is they only draw their guns because not because he's running away. It's because he hit Mr. Pendanski and hit him real hard, and they're worried he might do something more dangerous. Like, this could be a self-defense.
Sure.
And then when he starts running away, the warden decides, no, just like he'll come back. He's going to run out of water. But I also think this is irresponsible. Yes, it makes sense if you're talking about like an adult, but as a juvenile, wouldn't it be more responsible to run after him? Like, you've got plenty of people on your staff. You've got cars. Yeah. Come on. Go pick him up. Bring him back. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. You can catch up with him. It's just very silly, but...
It is. And it says, I think this is different from the movie. It says, Stanley noticed Zero's canteen lying on the ground near his hole. So, like, he doesn't even have his own canteen. He just left it.
I might just be making things up, but I think I remember him... Well, he had both hands free because the last thing he did was grab the shovel, swing it, and run.
Oh, that's true.
So he definitely
was it around his waist, though?
No, I don't think
like caveman's is?
I don't think so.
I don't know, actually.
Well, in the movie, I don't think he took a shovel with
him. No, he does take the shovel because they make the whole thing about
shovel up the mountain. Yeah, that's right.
I thought that... Yeah, okay, I'm not sure about Zero taking the water, but later on in our next episode, I'm more concerned about Caveman and his water, because he leaves with no water, and in the movie, he had like half a canteen or something. We'll talk about that later. But, in the interest of finishing out this chapter in this episode, Zero leaves, and Stanley's looking out, worried about him, and he's left his water completely. So my point is just that this is very dire. He has no water at all. And the warden examines her fingernails and said, "It's almost time for me to paint my nails again," which, like, is a threat, I think, mostly to her staff. Like, don't let stuff like this happen, or you'll turn out like Mr. Sir. But also, the kids go on later to say they're afraid of her striking them with her nails. And I'm wondering, is this a threat to the kids too? Like, don't act like Zero, because that is effed up if she's literally threatening, like, violence with rattlesnake venom to these kids.
I wonder if she's done that before, or, you know, maybe there's a, maybe there's some kind of apocryphal legend among the kids about, oh, one time she hit this kid with her fingernails.
Yeah, and she's aware of it and playing on it.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Pretty effed up. All in all, I'm just learning through these specific chapters in this episode that this camp is much darker and...
The camp is dark and full of terrors.
Yes, there you go. The camp is dark and full of terrors. That's what we'll end on. All right, you guys, I'll see you in the next episode. Audience, we'll see you soon. Tune back in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you have the time, guys, please rate and review us. It would mean the world. It bumps us up in the algorithm as a new podcast. It's huge. Also, word of mouth is going to be the biggest way to share this podcast. So if you know any decrepit millennials that need a little slice of happiness in their life, a little bump of nostalgia, please, please share with them. We would super appreciate it. All right. Tune in soon for the next episode. We love you.